Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation Fraud, Waste, Abuse here. And I'm with my two partners in crime, as you all know, Matt Kachansky, the retired special agent in charge from the OIG, the Northeast UPIC director, and now the director of our payment integrity team, and one of his right-hand men, Wade McFall, who I think before he started working for Matt had a full head of hair, and it was dark.
It was.
Wade, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office, and the retired, what else? I think that's it. Retired special agent in charge. And then, Wade spent a little bit of time on the medic contract, and that's going to be important. The medic, for those of you that don't know, is the benefit integrity team that is involved. They're kind of the UPIC compadres. They do Medicare Advantage and they do Medicare Part D as in dog. And for those of you that aren't inherently conversant with Medicare Part D, which is the drug benefit, it was created in 2006 during the Bush 2 administration. And so prior to that, we at the OIG did not really deal a lot with drug related cases. But after that, we then started to do pharmaceutical related cases. And that's when the medic came to be. So the case we want to talk about today, again, we're spending the next few weeks talking about relevant cases that are out there. There's a case that came out recently, a couple of weeks ago in the press, involving a provider in my state of New Jersey. It was a predominantly Medicaid fraud case, although there was Medicare involved with it, involving a doctor who was an internal medicine doctor. I'm going to focus on that for a minute. Internal medicine doctor, and got hung up for writing prescriptions that were inappropriate and bogus for a bunch of drugs, including oxycodone, fentanyl, and promethazine and codeine. And for those of you that aren't inherently familiar with promethazine and codeine, street name is sometimes known as SZRP or lean. When you do it without codeine, it's a cough suppressant. When you do it with codeine, it's a cough suppressant that knocks you out. And it is a common street drug. It's stolen from pharmacies, usually in very large bottles. It has a pretty audacious taste. And so what the people that want to use it will do is they will put it into frozen styrofoam cups with a lot of ice and then mix it with a flavored soda, like a grape soda or something like that. Moral of the story is if you're ever out and about and you're ever in a corner store, or as we call it in New York, a bodega, if you're ever in a small little corner store and in the freezer section, they have cases of frozen styrofoam cups. That's the reason why, for the most part, people don't go in there and buy a frozen styrofoam cup for their grape knee-high by itself. It's usually because they're pouring that in there. So we want to talk about this a little bit. You know, one of the things that becomes an important piece of the puzzle when we're talking about these what they call Title 21 cases for drugs or Title 18 cases of healthcare fraud, there's a Supreme Court decision over the past couple of years known as Ruan. It made its way up to the Supreme Court. It talked essentially about subjective understanding. It's created some hurdles for law enforcement and the government to prove intent, because a lot of this then also relies upon the fact that the provider, you have to be able to show that the provider wrote that prescription for an unauthorized use or purpose and knew that it was for an unauthorized use or purpose, meaning that the doctor wasn't writing a prescription that was part of their licensure and they thought they were doing it the right way. A little bit of this parlays into some recent Supreme Court cases that involve what they call subjective understanding. In the False Claims Act world, one of the things involves what's known as scienter, meaning what is the mindset of the person, that what was their subjective understanding of a policy, or what was their subjective understanding about what they were doing when it came time to submitting claims for things, and did they think they were doing it in the right course of business. Now, in this case, the facts are pretty unbelievable. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. The provider was essentially trading sex, oral sex, anal sex, and some other things in return for prescriptions for some of these drugs. It appears that some of the patients were complaining back to the staff. So there might've been some cooperating witnesses on this vis-a-vis, not necessarily a whistleblower case, but at least from a witness perspective on this. And whether or not that criminal intent was there, some other facts out there. The provider was submitting claims for dates of service when some of the members that he was billing for were in local jails, hadn't been there, things of that sort. So a lot of interesting pieces of the puzzle. It looks like from the press releases that he was writing as many as 50 prescriptions a day which may or may not be an odd number. But, you know, obviously, when I read this, and Wade, you had some involvement with this case years ago and dealt with it on one of our other contracts, particularly in the Medicaid space after your medic time when you came here. And, you know, obviously, the first thing when I read this was the fact that he was an internal medicine doctor. And, you know, the example that I was just giving before we, you know, recorded this was the discussion of the person goes for an acute pain problem where your doctor maybe gives you 3 or 4 days of a prescription of pain medicine and says, you know, try this before it becomes something where you need to go for more intervention. But, you know, as an internal medicine doctor, providing routine care that involves pain management is probably not the smartest thing in the world to do. And you had some opportunities on one of our SIU contracts where you actually interacted with this doctor and his practice and what have you. And obviously, when I read the press release and do a little bit of homework on this, the thing that kind of stands out to me is 50 prescriptions a day for pain management for an internal medicine doctor. And then some of the other things that apparently, you know, you identified in some of the investigation. So let's talk a little bit about, so, you know, first thing that comes to mind for me is if you're an internal medicine doctor, what on God's green earth are you doing writing 50 prescriptions a day in some cases for Schedule II drugs like oxycodone, fentanyl, and or promethazine and codeine. And then collaterally, you know, some of the other potential issues involving billing and coding and the like, right?
Right. Yeah, so it was brought to our attention through the pharmacy board, a pharmacy board investigator. And of course they have, you know, it's most of this stuff in one way or another is brought to our attention through the data. And this was no different, where there was typical like pill mill indicators that these different flags or algorithms pick up. And in this case, it was a very high percentage of what they considered CDS, controlled dangerous substances, which you mentioned some of them. It's oxy, and it was oxy combined with acetaminophen is a big flag because that's typically doesn't go together unless you're doing it for things like Sazerp or different street drugs. So that combo, and then also the promethazine with cyclobenzaprine, which is a muscle relaxer. So
Flexeril. Cyclobenzaprine, yeah. Its common name, or the name that people know it mostly, is Flexeril.
Yeah.
Yep, muscle relaxing.
So in it's one thing if it's, as you alluded to, if it's a pain management physician, you might see more of this. But for an internal medicine physician to be an outlier in these areas is a flag. We call it a clue. The other thing in this case, there was, which is another typical clue, not only in the pill mill cases, but in a lot of them that we've talked about on a regular basis, there was a number, like dozens of members who got these prescriptions from him, and there was no prior relationship. So they had never been to this doctor before. They weren't there with back pain. They weren't there with whatever. The first encounter with him, at least according to the data, was the day that he prescribed these medicines for him. So there's another red flag. Another kind of off the, away from being a typical pill mill case, in this case, there was also a very high percentage of a certain procedure code 99406, where he was billing for smoking cessation. They do a lot of different types of that. There's alcohol cessation, smoking cessation. But in this case, another time where it's good to do those beneficiary or those member interviews, a lot of the members that were interviewed identified that they've never been a smoker. So why are we doing smoking cessation? Why are we billing for that? And even the physician himself said, well, it doesn't matter if they weren't a smoker. You can still do smoking cessation as like a preventative. I don't think that's what was the intent for this procedure code, but he was trying to, you know, substantiate why he was doing it. So again, it's the type of thing where it's all these flags that line up. It's the overprescribing, being an outlier, not only in the number that you're prescribing, but out of your practice. And then these other no prior relationship is always a big one.
Well, you know, and the thing I always think is kind of interesting, if that's the reason for doing the smoking cessation, is you and Matt at your tender ages, you never know. You might wake up one day and say, yeah, F it. I'm going to start smoking Lucky Strikes without a filter. So, you know, it's kind of like, it's like Dare, right? Let's stop you from smoking before you have a chance to smoke, because at 60 years old, you know, you and Matt, I'm pretending you're 60, even though we know you're much older than that.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
But it's one of those weird things, you know, and like I said, I just went for a physical a few months ago, and I got there and I filled out an alcohol screening form and a depression screening form. And, you know, but I'm here. So I clearly wasn't depressed, or they didn't diagnose me. But I thought it was amazing that I filled out the form. There was no discussion with my doctor about it or anything. And it wasn't that it paid a lot of money, but it clearly is, like, you know, I would almost say like a COVID add-on test, right? Like, it's an add-on to something. But I think that's, you know, a piece. From the data, you know, obviously the thing way that comes up, that comes about on some of these, is if the first visit with this guy is, I'm writing you a script. The other thing too is, now on some deep web, Reddit or something else, one of these websites, is there information to say that this guy's a friendly doctor? So I'll give you one of the last cases I worked for. I retired, involved a lady who was from a fairly wealthy family, was involved in a horseback riding. She had horses in her family, got involved in an accident, hurt her back, and then became hooked on fentanyl and oxy. And what she was doing was going to the doctor every month, getting the prescriptions, and then only using her insurance to bill one and then paying cash for the other. Now, SIUs don't inherently have access to the prescription drug monitoring program, or the PMP or the PDMP, but investigators do. And we noticed that when she was going to the pharmacy, she was using her insurance for one and paying cash for the other. Ultimately, she overdosed, because she went to the doctor, got her prescriptions, went home that night, and had a party with herself involving both the oxy and the fentanyl. The interesting thing there was, the doctor that I was investigating, similar to this guy, was an internal medicine doctor. He was not board certified, so that should be a flag right there. And people were driving 50 and 60 miles away to go see him. And in an interview that he had done, he indicated that 94% of his patients were on some sort of opioid that he was prescribing. And what we learned was, the way that the patients found him was that there was a website, and he was known as a friendly doctor for getting prescriptions. So you had people driving 50, 60 miles away. So data will tell you that. If he's billing for a smoking cessation visit, if he's even billing for an E&M, which he should be, because you can't get prescriptions for more than a 30-day visit, you should be looking and seeing, why are people driving to some run-of-the-mill internal medicine who's a no-one doctor? It's not like this is the only internal medicine guy in a 100-mile radius, but that's obviously something that should be raising red flags. So even if you don't have access to the PDMP, you know, some of these other things kind of stand out from a combination of that and public data. I'm guessing if we went in and did a little bit of Google searching, we might find some information. I have not done that, but if we went and did a little bit of Google searching, we might find that there is some information about him being a friendlier guy to that. So, Matt, you know, what it then ultimately comes down to, and I brought up the Ruan case, because the Ruan case set a standard by which investigators and prosecutors need to follow from a case law perspective about how they're going to do these cases. So prior to Ruan, your subjective intent wasn't a factor. Were you able to convince a jury that writing 50 prescriptions for oxy was a pill mill? And that was the standard. And Ruan changed that standard, where if a doctor thought that he was doing or she was doing the right thing, then you can't do that. And, you know, I worked on a project recently with a doctor who was a urologist. And he was at times treating some patients who had cancers of the bladder and the urinary tract. And so what he would do is, he would prescribe limited, but he would prescribe Supsis, right? The sublingual drug. And there was an argument about whether or not he was prescribing this kind of willy-nilly, and the data showed that he really wasn't. And there was a lot of nonsense on it, to be honest. But, you know, he was a urologist treating a very large number of patients. And the percentage of patients that actually he was prescribing Supsis to, which was a very limited number of patients for a very limited time, like, you know, it makes it for a very challenging case. But this just goes to show you that it is important, regardless of whether you're on an SIU, payment integrity, understanding what the big cases are in your either whether it be a Supreme Court case or even an appellate court case, something, keeping up with the latest and greatest on healthcare fraud related case law in conjunction with the regulations and the statutes is going to help you with understanding workflows, ROI, and unfortunately or fortunately in the payment integrity director's roles, it's keeping up with some of this stuff to understand, are these cases that we should be investigating based upon the facts we know at the time?
Yeah, I remember that when that decision came down, it changed the way the investigators had to approach those cases. I mean, before, as Wade pointed out, you know, it was data driven. You know, they went over certain numbers of pills and the MDEs or whatever, the amount per day was in a dangerous thing. Those were the things they were bringing forward for cases without even going into what was the diagnosis of the patient, who is this patient population, going into any of the things that would give you that mindset. Well, this decision, you know, changed all that. So they had to change the way they were doing business. So going out and doing member interviews, doing an on-site, you know, even doing a surveillance to see, you know, is there a ring of people around this building before they open waiting to get their script? You really have to pay attention to those things because it is going to frame the way an investigator has to develop the evidence, because the burden of proof has changed, you know, and probably for the better, because, you know, bad facts make bad law. I've got a feeling that the case that finally changed that law was probably something that, like you were talking about, the doctor had at least the argument of a legitimate reason for doing what they did, and they couldn't figure out what was in his mind other than, you know, I was doing what I had to do for my patients. So you have to get over that burden.
I think the challenge in a lot of instances, so on the False Claims Act case, which talks about like this, you know, and that case, by the way, is known as the super value case, which is the subjective understanding when you submit a claim for something or when you do something, did you do something with the knowledge and intent that what you were doing was wrong or a violation? And, you know, the problem in our space, unfortunately, is that oftentimes regulations can be read two different ways. The kind of collateral problem is that as a result of, with super value, what it did was it took away, it was the overturning of what was formerly known as the Chevron doctrine, right? Which was allowing the agencies to determine what the best way of interpretation of a policy is. Super value actually brought that back to the courts to make those determinations. But you couple that with these other cases on the False Claims Act side, which talk about what the subjective understanding of an individual was at the time that they did what they did. This is kind of in that same vein from the criminal perspective. And the challenge is it then puts the onus on an investigator to climb inside the mind of the individual to say, are you interpreting this policy with a malicious intent, or is your intent, you know, is your subjective understanding something other than? And, you know, the problem that you've got when you look at the reversal of the Chevron case, which is, you know, the agencies that had historically been, or the entities that had historically been in the best position to interpret the policies of the agency were the agency. And the courts, the Supreme Court, essentially usurped that authority back to themselves by saying that we think that the best people suited to interpret an agency's policy are the courts. The problem is, as we all know, the courts are not omnipotent, and judges don't necessarily know everything about everything that's out there. It's a learning curve for them. So you have that, and then you've got the False Claims Act issues involving, you know, this subjective understanding. And now you have on the criminal side for the drug cases this. And so it really becomes this moving ball of, is the juice worth the squeeze, Matt? Do we spend our time doing these things?
Yeah, as an SIU, you know, your number one goal is to protect your members. And I think if you see, you know, that the data is showing you that these dangerous substances are being given to them willy-nilly, there is an expectation you need to do something about it. Now, to take it to the level of a referral to law enforcement is where you have to make that decision. how far do I go in proving this person's intent, this provider's intent to simply provide these opioids or whatever, the Schedule II narcotics to my patients because I'm making something out of it, whether it's a false bill to the plan or, with this case, cash in kind in return for, you know, the prescriptions? Or is it, you know, or is it enough to maybe stop their behavior by terminating their relationship with your plan by saying, you know, the numbers themselves show that you're a danger to us, we're shutting you down, and then sharing that information with other plans to see if that can move forward? But you really have to, there is no squeezing of the juice here in terms of protecting your members. You have to take whatever actions you can. If you want to take it further, then you have to come up with an investigative plan that's going to get over those burdens of proof to get into the mind of the provider, whether that's through interviews of the members, which can be difficult because he's their source, or the provider is their source, you know, people in the office observing what is going on, whatever it might take. That's a decision you have to make in terms of resources. But to stop them from doing it, if the numbers are showing that they're a danger, that's something you need to do. That's always been the number one priority. And whether it's working with the state to take it to the next level, the licensing right. board.
Right. And there may be these instances where the investigation doesn't adequately make a determination about whether or not there's a fraud, waste, or abuse issue here, but there's something. And maybe that's where you need to have those relationships with your external stakeholders, i.e. regulatory agencies, licensing boards, things of that sort. You know, just the other day, I got a phone call from a friend of mine from college who's a lawyer, and she's now working in the New York area, and she's dealing with an issue that is a regulatory matter, and she's just stuck, and she doesn't even know who to talk to. So I put her in touch with some lawyers I know who do a lot of work with boards and that, but it just goes to show you that having connections to people who can help with navigating some of that, that's where having, from the SIU perspective and the payer perspective, having these open lines of communication with your state counterparts that do regulatory and things of that sort, because you may find an instance where something just doesn't pass your stink test, and it turns out that from a regulatory perspective, it's okay. It's just a weird carve out or something along those lines. I mean, this case kind of had a little bit of everything, because there were fabricated records that were uncovered. You had overuse of prescriptions. Wait, I didn't even know about the whole smoking cessation thing. But, you know, this isn't the first time that I've heard sex, drugs, and rock and roll, in exchange for prescriptions. Unfortunately, the problem is that when people are hooked on these drugs and they are finding a friendly doctor to constantly write so that they're not doctor shopping, the docs are it's predatory in nature. They already know that they've got a captive audience. They've got somebody that needs the drugs. And many of these people, unfortunately, be willing to do whatever they need to do in order to get what they need to feed that addiction that's out there, whether it be the oxy or the fentanyl. The promethazine one is, you don't really see a lot of doctor shopping with the promethazine. If you've ever had to take it, I mean, with the codeine, it does what it's supposed to do. It stops the cough, knocks you out, and then you wake up on your kitchen floor wondering what happened, smelling like grape knee-high with a frozen cup in your hand. So, I don't recommend it, but, it's one of those things where when you see these doctors writing these prescriptions and you hear about these collateral things, you know, whether it be because these were predominantly Medicaid, so they don't have the money to pay for the drugs, which is the often thing, is they're paying a portion of the money for they're paying for the drugs, for the prescriptions. In this instance, the doctor was taking advantage of that. How was he doing it? It was, through sexual favors for these vulnerable people.
Do you recall the OIG undercover several years ago where the doctor was going into the adult entertainment places and exchanging prescriptions for lap dances?
No. And was it tough when you came home smelling like bad cologne and glitter?
All I know is the undercover agent kept asking for the undercover funds in singles. So I thought that was
this happens. You're coming very close, Matt, to that age where you could be the OIG's next undercover.
Irv Howard. Yeah.
For all of these. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't. Yeah. For those who remember, there was a guy named Irv Howard who was he was part of OIG for many, many years. When I got hired, he had just retired. He wasn't an agent. He was like an analyst, but had been at CMS for many, many years. Much older gentleman. And in the early days when I was working out of New York, they were using him to go and sit in waiting rooms and things like that, because he actually was a Medicare beneficiary. So there is hope for you yet, Makachansky.
I might have another career.
You could have. You could have. You would wave. You would wave. Odd couple. The odd couple. But so
don't even think we did not recognize that you talked about the depression and the alcohol screening, and you said you're here because you passed the depression screening. You didn't say a word about the alcohol.
It is 5 o'clock somewhere in this hall.
You have to blow on your cup so it looks like it's coffee.
It is, exactly. So listen, you know, these press releases are great because they really do show. When you've got a case that's been brought to the government and it resolves itself, you really get to see a little bit of the purview of what was going on, you know, around it. But you also get to see from an investigative auditing perspective, SIU perspective, if you're a CPC, if you're a CPMA and you're doing this work, these are things you have to look at. You know, if the people are showing in their medical records that they don't smoke and there's a smoking cessation there, you know, auditors, coders, billers are the first line of defense when you have a provider that's incorrigible or engaged in malfeasance and doesn't care about what you have to say. You're the first line of defense in stopping it, whether it be making a phone call to the hotline, whether it be, you know, tracking that, whatever it may be. There's a million ways to go about doing it. But, you know, these are examples where when you read these press releases, they really give you a lot of purview into what's going on in the environment, but also with that particular provider. And from the SIU perspective, to look at these things and say, how would I, as an investigator, identify this as a fraud scheme, patient harm related issue, or what have you? There are a lot of kind of vignettes that you can put together in these to bring it all together. So good conversation, Wade. More importantly, the fact that this was a case that you actually had a little bit more information on. So that's good. So we weren't really doing it from the dugout. You were on the field for a few of the innings, so you got to see it. Interesting case as always. And, you know, look, we'll keep doing these. These are fun cases to talk about. Fun in some sense, not fun because it's people's lives. So it's, you know, it's tough stuff, but we'll keep looking at these. Again, every Friday, this comes to your inbox, YouTube, Spotify. Just go to YouTube, look up Advise Health or OIG Roundtable. It pops up. We got a lot more of these coming up. We got some great LinkedIn Lives. I'll be doing one. We got part one was just the other day with Dan Olson on data. We're going to be doing part two of that soon. We've got some stuff. We're going to be talking NAMPI's coming up in August. We're going to be doing a little bit of a primer. We will be there. Not all of us, but our one director, Dan Olson, will be there, retired from Deloitte in their data analytics team, is one of our directors on our payment integrity side. And he is going to be at NAMPI representing Advise. And so if you're going to be at NAMPI, we got a couple of podcasts we'll be doing specifically with Dan, so you could stop off and chat with him. And thanks, everybody, as always, for tuning in. And we'll see everybody on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you.
Thank you.